Pull up a chair. Because I want to tell you about an airplane that spent decades sitting in a Tennessee park, out in the open, getting rained on and sun bleached and forgotten. An airplane that had once been the most famous bomber in the world. An airplane that 11 young men flew through 25 missions of anti-aircraft fire and fighter attacks and frostbite at altitude over the most heavily defended airspace in Europe. An airplane that helped sell war bonds and fill movie theaters and give a battered nation something to cheer about in the darkest years of the Second World War. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we're talking about the Memphis Belle. Before we get into it, a quick word from the folks who help keep this show in the air. Today's episode is brought to you by AviationSold.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSold.com. All right? Let's go back to 1942. The 8th Air Force had just started sending heavy bombers over occupied Europe from bases in England. The theory was called daylight precision bombing. The idea was that American crews, flying in tight formations at altitude, could hit specific targets with enough accuracy to knock out German industry without leveling entire cities. The way the British night raids were doing, the theory sounded clean on paper. The reality was something else. The Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress. You probably know the shape. Four Wright R-1820 Cyclone radial engines, a wingspan of over 100 feet, a crew of 10 men, guns pointing in every direction. The Air Corps called it a fortress and meant it. The aircraft could take a tremendous amount of damage and keep flying. Crews who rode them would tell you, to the end of their lives, that the B-17 saved their lives over and over again. Brought them home with engines out, control surfaces shot away, fuselages that looked like Swiss cheese, but it was not invulnerable. And the skies over Germany in 1942 and 43 were not friendly skies. German anti-aircraft fire, which crews called flak, was thick enough over some targets that you could walk on it. Focke-Wulf 190s and Messerschmitt 109s came out of the sun with their guns blazing. Crews flew at 25,000 feet or higher with no pressurization in temperatures that dropped to 60 below zero. Frostbite was not a theoretical risk. It happened. Men lost fingers. Men lost toes. The oxygen masks could malfunction. The heated flight suits could short out, and all of this, all of it, happened while flak was punching holes in the fuselage and fighters were making pass after pass. A tour of duty for an 8th Air Force heavy bomber crew in 1942 was 25 missions. 25 and you were done. You could go home. The problem was that the statistical odds of actually surviving 25 missions were, in the early days, roughly even at best. Some analysts put them worse than that. Crews knew the math. They flew anyway. The Memphis Belle was assigned to the 91st Bomb Group, 324th Bomb Squadron, based at Royal Air Force Bassingbourne in Cambridgeshire, England. Her pilot was Captain Robert Morgan, 23 years old, from Asheville, North Carolina. He named the airplane after a young woman he was in love with back home. Her name was Margaret Polk. She lived in Memphis, Tennessee. He had a friend paint her likeness on the nose of the aircraft, the way thousands of American crews painted names and nose art on their bombers. A piece of home in a cold, dangerous sky. The Memphis Belle started flying combat missions in November of 1942. Her targets ranged across occupied France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Germany itself. Submarine pens at Wilhelmshaven. Rail yards. Industrial targets. The kinds of targets that the strategic bombing campaign was designed to destroy. Now here's where it gets interesting. 25 missions, remember. That was the magic number, and as the Memphis Belle and her crew climbed through the missions, one by one, someone back at 8th Air Force headquarters noticed that this particular crew was getting close, and someone else noticed that this would make for one heck of a story. The American public needed good news. The war was grinding. The Pacific theater was brutal. The news from North Africa was mixed. Here was something the press could use, the first complete American heavy bomber crew to finish their tour and come home alive. Every newspaper in the country would want that story. William Wyler was already in England. He was one of the most accomplished directors in Hollywood, the man who would eventually give the world Mrs. Miniver and the best years of our lives in Ben-Hur. He had enlisted in the Army Air Forces and been assigned to make a documentary. He flew combat missions himself to get footage. He was on board B-17s while they were being shot at. The footage he brought back was real. The danger was real. His documentary, Memphis Belle, A Story of a Flying Fortress, would come out in 1944. It is still worth watching, but before the documentary, there was the tour. On May 17, 1943, the Memphis Belle and her crew flew their 25th mission. They came back, all 10 men. All four engines. they had done what a lot of people thought was statistically improbable, and they had done it flying one of the most demanding and dangerous jobs in the war. The Army Air Forces sent them home. What followed was a 9-city war bond tour across the United States. The crew and the airplane traveled together. Crowds turned out everywhere. Newspapers covered every stop. They were heroes at a moment when the country needed heroes, and they wore it with the kind of uncomfortable grace that young men from the 1940s seemed to manage. They did not ask for any of it. They had just been trying to finish their missions and go home, same as everyone else. After the tour, the Memphis Belle was retired from combat. She had done her job twice over. The crew scattered. Some of them went back to Europe to fly more missions. Some of them became instructors. The war ground on for 2 more years after that 25th mission, and the men of the Memphis Belle kept doing their part, in the air and on the ground. And the airplane? She ended up in the city she was named for.
Memphis, Tennessee accepted the airplane as a gift after the war. She was put on display at the Tennessee Air National Guard base, and for a while she was maintained and respected. She was a landmark, a piece of living history. Then the decades went by. By the 1970s and 80s, the Memphis Belle was in serious trouble. She had been moved outside. Memphis is not a gentle climate, hot summers, wet winters. The sun bleaches aluminum. Rain finds every seam. Vandals over the years had taken souvenirs, literally pulling pieces off the aircraft. The nose art was faded. Fabric control surfaces were rotting. The interior was deteriorating. One of the most famous aircraft in the history of American air power was falling apart in a park. People tried to help. Local volunteers did what they could. There were fundraising efforts. But the scale of what was needed was beyond what a city park budget was going to handle. Finally, in the early 2000s, the Air Force stepped in. The National Museum of the United States Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, arranged for the Memphis Belle to be transferred there. She arrived in 2004, and that is when the real work began. The restoration of the Memphis Belle took close to 14 years from start to completion. That number alone should tell you something about the scale of the job. The museum's restoration team went through the aircraft, essentially piece by piece. Every rivet was inspected, every skin panel was evaluated. Systems that had been stripped or damaged had to be researched and refabricated from original drawings. Finding accurate documentation for a specific variant of the B-17F from 1942 is not a quick afternoon in the library. It meant deep archival research, correspondence with other museums and collectors, hunting down original Boeing drawings, interviewing surviving crew members while they were still alive to be interviewed. The 4 Wright Cyclone radial engines were restored. The guns were restored. The interior was brought back to represent the aircraft as she would have appeared during her combat career. The nose art was carefully restored. The name on the nose and the face beneath it came back. On May 17, 2018, exactly 75 years to the day after the crew of the Memphis Belle flew their final mission, the museum unveiled the completed restoration.
If you have not been to the National Museum of the United States Air Force, I need to tell you something. It is one of the greatest aviation museums on Earth. Full stop. It is free to visit. It is enormous. It houses aircraft from the Wright brothers' era through the space age. The collection is staggering, and the Memphis Belle is in the World War II gallery, displayed indoors, in climate-controlled conditions, the way she should be. She sits there among other aircraft of her era. A North American B-25 Mitchell, a Martin B-26 Marauder, fighters and transports and trainers from the period. You can walk underneath her and look up at that swept wing and those 4 radials and understand, physically, what it meant to fly one of these things. She is not small, she is formidable, and she is complete. What strikes me about the Memphis Belle, every time I think about this story, is the human scale of it. Robert Morgan was 23 years old when he started flying combat missions. Most of his crew were the same age or younger. They were farm boys and city kids and college students who had learned to fly a few years before. In the frantic expansion of American military aviation after Pearl Harbor, they were handed a 100-foot-wide bomber and told to fly it at altitude over the most dangerous skies in the world, against the most sophisticated air defenses ever built at that point in history, and they were expected to do it 25 times. They did, and the airplane they flew is still with us. That is what a good restoration does. It keeps the human story alive. The Memphis Belle is not just aluminum and engines. She is the record of something that actually happened. 10 young men actually flew those missions. They actually came home, and the airplane that brought them home is sitting in Dayton, Ohio, right now, fully restored, open to the public, waiting for you to come and stand underneath her and think about what she represents.
I think about the people who worked on that restoration. 14 years of their professional lives. Volunteers who gave their weekends. Archivists who tracked down original drawings. craftspeople who refabricated parts that no longer existed anywhere. They did it because they understood what was at stake. Because once an aircraft like this one is gone, it is gone. You cannot go back. Sources on this one include the National Museum of the United States Air Force's own documentation on the restoration project, the Tennessee Historical Commission records on the Bell's time in Memphis, and the historical research archived at the museum's library at Wright-Patterson. If you want to go deeper on the B-17 and the 8th Air Force's bombing campaign, Roger Freeman's work on the subject is the place to start. Find us at radiohangar.com. For Tail Dragger, and for the crew of the Memphis Belle, Blue Skies.